that I always enjoyed doing. And I worked on them. I always felt like the backhand play is probably the toughest place for most fielders because they really don't see the ball over here as well as they do right here. And so I worked on certain things that I didn't do well, but it pretty much came natural to me.
I think the plays we remember you for are those plays behind third base, especially in the World Series.
Yeah.
And then coming in on the slow roller or the bunt, you had to work on those.
I used to. There were several things I worked on the slow hit, the top balls or bunts that I used to go line about 10 or 12 balls up in a row, you know, and you just come in and pick one up, then you'd make another step and pick one up and throw it. And I worked on it that way. And, you know, I made a play in the World Series in 1970, which was very unusual because I usually don't, I can't ever remember, but maybe one other time my whole career making it like I did. But Lee May hit a ball over the third base bag, which I caught in foul territory and just got and one threw it and one hopped the Boog Powell and got Lee May out.
That's a famous play. We see that over and over.
But that's just most of the time when you make that play, you gather the get the ball, you stop, you plant, you make the long throw. But this time I just got it and wheeled and threw. And I can't even remember making that play maybe one time like that in my whole career. But it was just it just happened that way.
Clay Carroll said your glove went one way, your body another, and your shoes another.
Yeah. Well, Lee May, he gives me a little humility all the time. Every time I see him, he always says, well, you know what? You're lucky I hit those balls to you in that World Series because no one would ever heard of you if I didn't. You know? So he keeps my feet on the ground with a little humility.
That's what I say to Ralph Branca. If you'd struck him out, Ralph, nobody would have heard of
him. That's right. That's a good point. Absolutely.
Your all-star appearance. Who were some of the all-stars that you got to locker with and play with that first year? Do you remember that one well?
Oh, I remember that well. A good story. Ted Williams was on that team, of course, and I got to. I keep telling everyone I got the pinch run for him, but I don't think that's true. That's probably not true. I don't know, but anyway, that goes back how many years? Anyway, but anyway, Ted Williams was on that team. And I think that's the year we played two games. We played in Kansas City, then we went to New York. But I got on the plane after the first game, and Lou Fonseca, who was doing the game for one of the beverage companies at that particular time, doing the filming for it, and a great hitter in his own right, I think, too. But anyway, Lou Fonseca and Ted Williams were sitting together. And they were talking to Nellie Fox and trying to tell Nellie how he'd be a better hitter if he stood off the plate a little and back in the box some, you know. But anyway, Ted started talking about the slider breaking 59.6 inches. And I'm listening to this, you know, and I'm saying, I tell you what, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to hit Major League pitching. You're talking about things I never heard about, you know. But that was a big thrill, being on the team with Ted Williams that year. And we didn't win too many games. In fact, I hold it. One of the records I'm not too proud of is I hold a record for playing in the most losing All-Star games. I played in 18 games. We tied one. I won two, and I lost 15. So anyway, that's another story.
Different philosophies in the league then, though.
I guess there were, you know, but really there were. I don't know if there's any different philosophy. I mean, we wanted to win as bad as the National League, but. When you look at it, they were probably a little better. They started signing the black, you know, like Aaron and Mays and Clemente, and they got a jump on signing the black players and Ernie Banks, and they just made the difference. And that's why they probably were a little better than we were. But you know, I always look back at all the scores of the games, and we were in every game. I mean, I remember playing here in '64 and playing in New York at Shea Stadium, and all we had to do is get them out, and Callison hit a two or three run homer off of Raddatz, you know. But we had a lot of games like that. So anyway, but we came out on the losing end.
You know, I think for the historians, though, it's probably worth spending a minute on the black issue because your generation coming along. The Red Sox didn't have a black player until late.
Sure. Pumpsy Green.
People have to remember that the National League in 47 started signing significant number of players.
Yeah.
Musial told us that he knew the Cardinals would never win after the Dodgers signed the black guys because he knew the Cardinals couldn't sign them. They were a Southern team.
And yeah,
he
right.
He said, we never won again. And I'm thinking of the Red Sox, the Yankees. I mean, Howard didn't come until, what, 55? Didn't have any real black players, so the Yankees were loaded, but they were basically white.
Mm-hmm.
And the American League, it seemed to me, struggled in those years. I mean, it took a long time to make up that
gap. Well, you're right. The American League did struggle, and it's the fact that you're right. They didn't sign the black players. They weren't in a hurry to sign them. I mean, Boston, for instance, and the Yankees, and the players that the National League did sign. I mean, when they signed them, they got the best. You're talking about guys like Campanella and Robinson and
Banks, as you say. Banks. I mean, imagine.
Yeah. Ernie and
Mays.
Right. I first saw Ernie in 1956 in spring training. Ernie Banks and when he played with the Cubs with Gene Baker and Ernie Banks, that was a double play combination. But a lot of the American League teams were slow in signing the black players, and consequently, the league got behind.
Was there any talk about it? Did you guys ever discuss the fact that your league was dragging its feet?
I don't ever remember any talk about. Never thought too much about it, Faye. Probably a little blasé about the whole thing. Even going back to Little Rock Central High, you know. I mean, I thought everything was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then after, you know, you had the problems there in '57, and you begin to see, and then the players segregated in other hotels and in Miami, and it was sad. Really was, you know. But those guys, I don't really know how they felt. I mean, I never really sat down and talked to them. We'd go to the Sir Walter Raleigh and pick up the black guys after they picked us up, you know, at the other hotel. But they were there. I mean, their primary job was to play baseball, and they probably didn't think a whole lot about it. I can't say that. I mean, I can't read. But maybe they did think about it. They probably did, you know. But after years, you look back on it now and you say, boy, that was terrible.
And yet in 1966, when Frank came over, the way the Orioles greeted him, the way the Orioles insisted the city accommodate him housing-wise and everything, you were a part of a social revolution in itself in Baltimore. How were you aware of that and aware of the hardships he faced when he originally got to Baltimore?
I wasn't too aware of it till later, really, in finding out that, you know, he tells a story about a real estate agent taking his wife somewhere and saying, well, this is Robinson, and they thought it was Brooks Robinson, and they found out it was Frank, and they said, well, sorry, but we can't give you the house, or you can't buy the house. But Frank coming over, that's the greatest thing that ever happened to the Orioles. I mean, he made us a real winner coming over there. I mean, he was just made us a better team than a lot of other teams. But I mean, when he came over, there was a lot of trepidation because he came over with a reputation of some things that have happened in Cincinnati. I mean, they caught him carrying a gun one time, I guess, and some other things. So we kind of were standoffish, you know, and then he was too, certainly. I mean, after having a great career in Cincinnati, but when he got there, he just he really fit in well. We had enough good guys on that team, and we had a lot of fun that first year winning the World Championship when he came. So, but I think we all understood one another a lot better after he got there. But he did go through some tough times there in Baltimore, and I think that it was kind of a revolution, as you say, that happened, and it made it a lot better for a lot of the other athletes that followed him, I think.
On that 1966 team, he was obviously a major difference, but that's when the Orioles championship caliber team started to come together with Palmer and McNally. Could you spend a little time on
wasn't
the players
Baylor
on that
there
team?
Too?
Baylor came up after Frank Robinson left.
Yes. Yeah.
But that was a great team, the beginning of the great pitching staff, the 20-game winners, the four 20-game winners. Could you spend a little time starting with Frank and the difference he made?
Well, Frank came over in 1966, and we had a fairly young team that year. We had a rookie catcher in Andy Etchebarren, a rookie second baseman in Davey Johnson, a rookie outfielder in Paul Blair in center field. So we had a young team. Jim Palmer came on board, and Dave McNally also. We had a young pitcher named Wally Bunker, who was pitching for a 1966 team. I don't think we had over a 15-game winner, but we were basically offense that year. We had three guys that drove in over 100 runs, Frank and Boog and myself, and we just kind of outclassed everyone that year. And of course we went to the World Series and played the Dodgers as underdogs, and won four in a row. I think the series ended where we had the worst team batting average for a winning team, and they had the worst team batting average for a losing team in World Series history. There wasn't much happening after the first inning of the first game. Frank and I hit back-to-back home runs in that first game, and that was about the extent of the scoring. Drabowski came on and in relief that first day and struck out 8 out of 9 guys, I believe, and then of course, the next three games were shutout. That was the second game. Was the last game that Koufax ever pitched. They made 6 errors behind him, and we won 6-0, I believe. But that was the last game that Sandy ever pitched, and then we won the last two games, 1-0, 1-0, and Frank was the MVP. But that was the start of some nice years for us. And 67 didn't do well. 68, almost won. Detroit won that year. Frank got hurt in 67. I believe it was he had a concussion that he played with most of the year, and that hurt us a lot. And then, of course, we got in the World Series in 69, 70, and 71. So, pitching really became a force in 69. Mike Cuellar joined us from Houston, and for 3 years there, 3 or 4 years, you could put Cuellar at the top. I mean, he was as good as anybody who pitched. And of course, in 71, we had the 420 game winners. Pat Dobson joined us in 71, and the four guys won 20 games, and that's will never happen again. They were very competitive. They just wanted the ball every fourth day. Now you got guys who pitch, you know, every fifth day or sixth day, but that's just the way the game has changed. But these guys, they love to work on 4 days, and they wanted to be the best. And, of course, those were great teams. Consequently, we lost 2 out of 3 of those World Series. We lost to the Mets in 69, which is a big upset. And then we were the underdogs in 70-1, and then we were supposed to beat Pittsburgh, and they beat us. But in baseball, you win. If you get the recognition when you win, and consequently we lost 2 out of 3 of those World Series. But just getting to a World Series is exciting. When you look back at all the players in the history of the game who never got a chance to be there, Ernie Banks or Billy Williams or Ferguson Jenkins or George Kell, who finished his career. And not to digress, but that 57 season, it's okay if I go back here.
Oh, absolutely.
That 57 season, the thing that was so nice about me being with George Kell, and he grew up like 60 miles from me, as I told you. But his career ended then. But in 83, I went into the Hall of Fame through the regular voting phase, and George went in through the old-timer. So here we're on the stage together going into the Hall of Fame together, which made it that much more exciting. That
of course, he had spent most of his career in Detroit and
yes.
had such a terrific record as a batter. And
he led the league 1 year. He beat out Ted Williams, but terrific hitter.
Good fielder.
Good fielder. And ended up going to Chicago, Boston, ended up his career in Baltimore. But we became real close during those years.
Let me take you back to Paul Richards, because in those years, Paul left and there was a managing change. And I want to take you and get more of a picture about the role of a manager and how you related to a manager and how important you think a manager is. And let me just set the stage. I mean, Casey Stengel managed in Boston and had a terrible record. Came to the Yankees, won terrifically, and then went to the Mets. And so obviously the players are the critical ingredient. But nevertheless, I'm interested, and I think the historians will be interested, in what's your view of the importance of a manager? How does a manager make a difference in the creation of a winning team?
Well, I think the manager is a major ingredient. I really do. I think that there's so much that a manager can do. And I think the players, after watching a manager for so long, they begin to see what difference a manager can make, I think. I mean, it's not all on the field it happens, but it's off the field too. But I just think players recognize managers in a hurry who cannot manage, who cannot run the game the way it's supposed to be ready to make the moves. And in that sense, they can become very critical of managers. But I think there is certain things that managers do during the season to win ball games, and you've got to be pretty consistent. But I think you've got 25 guys, and you've got to be able to make every guy feel important. And I think that's what the great managers do. Earl Weaver, whether you be the 25th guy on that team or you're the star of that team. I mean, he treated everyone the same. Everyone knew their job. Everyone knew that when they were going to be called on, everyone knew that they had to be ready. And a manager in that respect can do things to gain the player's confidence.
Okay, we have to stop here. We'll change the tape now, gentlemen. If you don't mind, Bruce, I want to go back. Here.
Sure.
Because they will have read about you and they'll read about how you dominated the
program. Too. So anytime you want to input, all
right? Thank you. Thank you so much.
Stand by, please. Yeah. 3, 2, 1.
We were talking about managers and the difference they made. Brooks, can you talk a little bit about the difference in the way they manage from Weaver on the one hand and Paul Richards on the other? Were they Richards, I always had the sense, was much more of a do-it-my-way disciplinarian, had very clear ideas about how he wanted to run the team, but I wasn't a player. Can you talk about what he was like as a manager?
No, Paul Richards was a disciplinarian, you're exactly right, and it was my way or the highway. That's just kind of the way he operated, but he had a lot of young players, and as I said before, I thought he was God. I mean, I just never... he taught me things about the game of baseball that I never even thought about when I was a youngster. I mean, as far as rundowns and cutoffs and he knew every phase of the game, knew what made every position tick, and he was in charge.
Now, suppose you botched a rundown. You know, a guy gets caught between third and home, and you run him toward home, and he scores. What would Paul Richards do? I mean, how would he deal with you? Would he deal with you then? Was it the next day?
Paul had his own way of dealing with players who made, so he would call you into his office and he'd say, son, this is the way we have to do this. You know, it was like that. But Paul was, I got to know Paul Richards a lot better when back in the 80s after I started doing the games on television and he was down in Texas. I had more conversation with him then than I ever did, and this gained a lot of respect for him, even more so because Paul was the type of fella, you'd get on the elevator with him at the 10th floor or somewhere, and He would never say good morning. I mean, he just looked like he was in deep concentration about something else. But he might—he was a man of few words. But when you did something, you had to do it his way. That's basically the way he operated.
Now, suppose you made a bad throw, just a physical mistake. Would he be as tough on that as making a mistake of you know, just?
No, physical mistakes really, I don't think that he looked at them. I mean, that's going to happen. But mental mistakes, he couldn't put up with. And that's just, but when you make a bad throw or miss a ground ball, that's part of the game. But I think he was a terrific judge of talent. I mean, I just felt like that he resurrected so many pitchers' careers. Billy Lowe's when he came down to Baltimore, Skinny Brown, Jim. We had guys that he was able just to resurrect their careers pitching-wise, which I thought was phenomenal.
And, he brought Connie Johnson there, didn't he?
Connie Johnson, you're absolutely right. Connie Johnson became an outstanding pitcher with the Orioles. I'm trying to think of some more guys there that he helped, but he really became known as someone who could. He was a catcher all his life. He played in the 45 World Series for Detroit. But catchers seem to have a little better insight on being able to help pitchers than a lot of players
do. Is it true that he invented the big catcher's mitt for the knuckleball pitchers?
Yeah, we had a catcher by the name of Clint Courtney and Gus Triandos, and that's when Paul Richards came up with the large mitt to catch Hoyt Wilhelm.
Oh, yeah.
And I tell you what, Gus Triandos, the day that he would come to the park and Wilhelm was pitching, Gus was in another world. I mean, he hated it. He knew that he was going to be running back to the backstop for many times during the game to pick up the ball because Wilhelm had such a great knuckleball. You're just not going to catch it all the time. And of course, Hoyt Wilhelm's in the Hall of Fame too. But we had Clint Courtney, and they always used to say when Courtney was going after a pop up of that big glove, he looked like a guy carrying a pizza, you know, trying to catch a ball. But Paul Richards very innovative and.
And what year did he leave?
He left probably in 61 or 62 to go to Houston.
Yeah.
And Lumen Harris took over and managed the rest of the year. And then Billy Hitchcock came on board for about a year or two. Then Hank Bauer, the old Yankee, took over in 1964. That was his first year. And he led us to the first World Championship. And Hank Bauer basically... not much strategy, just put you out there and let you play, and that was it. Same guys every day almost, and we just had a little more talent that year than